In the cellar, in the darkness, the sorcerer Mortis sat alone amid blocks of ice and felt his body decay. The pain howled within him, awful and never-ending, gnawing away at his courage and his sanity. At first, the concentration needed to maintain Adamant's defenses helped protect him from the pain and the horror of his situation. But it wasn't enough anymore. Through all the endless hours of the day and night, there was nothing for him to do but sit and think and feel. Mortis passed through anger, acceptance, horror, and now existed from minute to minute in quiet desperation. He long ago gave up hope. He would have gladly gone mad if he hadn't needed to keep control to protect Adamant. He still might. More and more his thoughts wandered, fraying at the edges. No one had been to see him for a long time. He could understand that. It was cold in the cellar, and they all had things to do, important things. But time passed slowly in the dark, and it had been so long. And Adamant, his good friend, James Adamant, came least of all. Mortis sat alone in the cold, in the dark, in the pain, going slowly insane and knowing there was nothing he could do to stop it. Medley breezed into the study with a sheaf of papers in his hand and then stopped dead as he saw Hawk and Fisher.
Oh, damn. You wanted to see me, didn't you? Sorry, but James has been running me off my feet this morning. What can I do for you?
To start with, tell us about the embezzlement. Exactly how much money has gone missing?
A fair amount.
Medley sat casually on the edge of Adamant's desk.
About 3,000 ducats in all, spread over a period of 3 months. Small amounts at first, but growing steadily larger.
Who has access to the money?
That's the problem. Quite a few people. James and myself, of course. Danielle, the butler Villiers, and half a dozen other servants. And, of course, several reform people who worked on the campaign with us.
We'll need a list of names.
I'll see you get it.
How was the money taken?
I'm not actually sure. The accountants were the first to notice something was wrong. Do you want to take a look at the books?
Hawk and Fisher looked at each other.
Maybe later. Tell me about Adamant. How has he responded to the death threats?
Fairly coolly. They're not the first he's had, and they won't be the last. It's a part of politics in Haven. The magic attacks worry him, of course. Mortis isn't as reliable as he once was.
And why doesn't he hire a new sorcerer?
Mortis is James's friend, and he lost his life defending James from attack. James can't just abandon him. And besides, when he's in form, Mortis is still one of the most powerful sorcerers in Haven.
They sat in silence for a while, each looking expectantly at the other.
If there's nothing else...
You're in charge of Adamant's affairs. Who do you think has been leaking information?
I don't know. It has to be someone with a grudge against James. But I'm damned if I know who. James is one of the fairest, most honorable men I know. The only enemies he has are political ones. Now, if you'll excuse me...
Medley dropped his papers on the desk, nodded briskly to the guards to indicate the interview was over, and left the study. Hawk let Medley go, then leafed through the papers on the desk. They told him nothing.
For a political advisor, he's either extremely tactful or not very bright. I can think of several possible enemies among Adamant's own people. Mortis, to start with. He saves Adamant's life and ends up a rotting corpse for his trouble. There's his wife, Danielle. She wouldn't be the first woman to be mad at her husband because he was more interested in his work than he was in her. And finally, what about Medley himself? He's in charge of the day-to-day running of the campaign, so who has a better chance to embezzle money without it being missed?
Wait a minute. Mortis and Danielle I'll go along with, but Medley? What's his motive?
As I understand it, he worked both sides of the political fence before he came to work for Adamant. He could still be on the conservative payroll as an undercover agent.
This is going to be another tricky one. If we point the finger at the wrong person, or even the right person, but without enough proof, we could end up in a hell of a lot of trouble.
You got that right.
Up in the Adamant's bedroom, Danielle sat elegantly on the edge of the bed and watched critically as James held a shirt up against himself for her approval. It didn't look any better than the first two, but she supposed she'd better agree to this one or he'd get annoyed with her. She wouldn't have minded if he just got red in the face and shouted at her, but James tended more to looking terribly hurt and put upon, and being icily polite when he wasn't sulking. Danielle sometimes found herself picking fights with the servants just to have someone she could yell at. At least some of them would yell back at her. She realized James was still waiting patiently. James smiled and finally put on his shirt. Danielle bit her lip. Better to say it now while he was in a good mood.
James, what do you think of Hawk and Fisher?
They seem competent enough, and surprisingly intelligent, for guards.
But do you think they'll be good at their job, as bodyguards?
No, certainly.
Then we don't need to rely on Mortis so much anymore, do we?
James looked at her sharply.
You've got to do something about Mortis, James. We can't go on as we are. We need real magical protection. It was different when we had no one else we could trust, but now we've got Hawk and Fisher.
Mortis is one of the most powerful sorcerers in Haven.
He used to be. Now he's just a corpse with delusions of grandeur. His mind is going, James. Those blood creatures weren't the first things to get past his wards, were they?
He's a friend. He gave his life for me. I can't just turn my back on him.
When was the last time you went to see him before today?
Adamant came and sat down on the bed beside her. He suddenly looked very tired.
I can't bear to see him anymore, Denny. Just looking at him makes me feel sick and angry and guilty. If he'd just died, I could mourn for him and let him go. But he isn't dead or alive. Just being in the cellar with him makes my skin crawl. The Sorcerer Mask was my friend, not that thing rotting in the darkness. But he was my friend, and if it wasn't for him, I would have died. Oh, Danny, I don't know what to feel anymore.
Danielle put her arms around him and rocked him back and forth.
Oh, I know, love. I know.
Danielle came into the study only a few minutes after Hawk sent for her. She smiled brightly at the two guards, closed the door, and sank gracefully into her favorite chair.
I do hope this won't take long. James is almost ready to go.
We just need to get a few things clear, nothing too difficult. How involved are you with the day-to-day running of your husband's campaign?
Not very. Stefan handles all that. I've no head for organizing things, so I let the two men get on with it. My job is to stand conspicuously at James' side and smile at anyone who looks like they might vote for him. I'm rather good at that.
What about the financial side?
I'm afraid I'm not very good with figures either. It's all I can do to handle the household accounts. Once I went a few hundred ducats over budget and James was positively rude to me. Stefan handles all the money to do with the campaign. That's part of his job.
Let's talk about the gossip.
What gossip?
Come on, there's always gossip, and you're in the best position to know about it. Servants will talk to you where they wouldn't talk to Adamant or Medley, or us.
Danielle thought for a moment and then shrugged.
Very well, but I can't vouch for how authentic any of this is. Stefan's been a bit distracted recently. Apparently he's got a new girlfriend he's very fond of, but he's trying to keep it quiet because James wouldn't approve of her. It seems she's minor quality, from a very conservative family with strong connections to Hardcastle. You can imagine what the broadsheet singers would make of that, if it ever got out.
How long has this been going on?
I'm not sure. About a month, I think.
After the problems with the embezzlement began?
Oh, well, after. Besides, Stefan would never betray James. He's far too professional.
Hawk caught the emphasis and raised an eyebrow.
I thought that was why Adamant hired him.
There's such a thing as being too professional. Stefan lives, eats, and breathes his work. His word is never broken, and he defends his reputation the way some women defend their honor. What's more, he works all the hours God sends, and expects James to do the same. It's all I can do to get the pair of them to eat regularly. I'll be glad when this bloody campaign is over and we can get back to normal.
Is there anything else you can tell us? Has anything unusual happened recently?
You mean apart from my garden disappearing overnight and a rain of blood in my hall?
I take your point.
Well, it was very nice talking to you both, but if you'll excuse me, James is waiting.
She swept out without waiting for permission to leave. Hawk waited until the door had closed behind her and then looked at Fisher.
So, Medley has a conservative lover. That could be significant. Perhaps there's some kind of blackmail involved.
Maybe.
But the embezzlement started months before he met her.
We can't be sure of that. He could have been seeing her for months before the servants got to hear of it.
Oh, this is going to be another complicated case, isn't it?
Stefan Medley sat alone in the library, staring at a wall of books and not seeing them.
I should have told Hawk and Fisher about my love. But I can't. They wouldn't understand.
Love was a new experience for Medley. The only passion he'd ever known before was for his work. Medley had long ago come to the conclusion that whatever women wanted in a man, he didn't have it. He wasn't much to look at, he had few social graces, and even less money, and his chosen career wasn't exactly glamorous. He didn't want much out of life, he just wanted someone to care for him who didn't have to, someone to give him a reason for living. He just wanted what everyone else had and took for granted, the something he'd never known. Now he'd found someone, or she'd found him, and he wouldn't give her up. He couldn't. She was all he had, except for James's friendship. Medley beat softly on the arm of his chair with his fist. James had believed in him, made him his right-hand man and his friend, trusted him above all others. And now here he was, selfishly keeping a secret that could destroy James's campaign if word ever got out. But he had to do it. James would never understand.
Of all the women I could have fallen in love with, it had to be her.
Except, of course, he had no choice in the matter. It just happened. Medley had always thought that falling in love when it finally happened would be gentle and romantic. In fact, it was more like being mugged. Overnight, his whole life had changed. Medley sat quietly while his mind worked frantically, turning desperately this way and that, searching for a way out of the trap he'd built for himself. There was no way out. Sooner or later, he was going to have to choose between his friend and his love, and he didn't know what would happen then. He couldn't give up either of them. They were the two sides of his nature, and they were tearing him
apart. More and more, this reminds me of the Blackstone case. Something nasty's gonna happen. We can all feel it in the air, and there's nothing we can do about
it. At least then we had a handful of suspects to choose among. Now we're stuck with two. The man's wife and his best friend. And the only skeleton in the closet we've been able to find is that Medley might be seeing a conservative girlfriend on the quiet. Hardly a burning motive for murder and betrayal, is it?
Don't look at me. You're the brains in this partnership. I just take care of the rough stuff. Conspiracies make my head hurt.
Right. There's still the butler, Villiers. Maybe he knows something. Servants always know things.
Whether he's prepared to talk to us about it is a different matter. If you ask me, Villiers is one of the old school. Faithful unto death and beyond, if necessary. We'll be lucky to get the time of day out of him.
Think positively, why don't you?
They both fell silent as the door swung open and Villiers came in. He bowed politely to the two guards. After shutting the door firmly, he stood to attention, waiting to hear what was required of him. His ramrod posture and dour expression gave him a solid dignity that was only partly undermined by the fluffy white tufts of hair that blossomed above his ears, in contrast to his resolutely bald head. He had dressed with exquisite care and wouldn't have looked out of place in a lord's mansion. So what was he doing working for a champion of the common people?
Take a seat.
Villiers shook his head slightly, but definitely.
I'd rather not, sir.
Why not?
It's not my place, madam.
He added the last word just a little too late.
How long have you been James Adamant's butler?
9 years, sir. Before that, I was butler to his father. The Villiers family has served the Adamant family for 3 generations.
Even during the bad times when they lost everything?
Every family knows disappointments from time to time.
How do you feel about Adamant's politics?
It's not my place to say, ma'am. My duty is to Master Adamant, and the Villiers have always known their duty.
How do you get on with Mrs. Adamant?
An excellent young lady, from a fine background, a strong support to Master Adamant. Her health has been a little delicate of late, but she has never allowed that to interfere with her duties to her husband and the household. Mrs. Adamant is a very determined young lady.
What's wrong with her health?
I really couldn't say, ma'am.
How do you feel about Stephen Medley?
Mr. Medley seems quite competent in his work, sir.
How about his private life?
Villiers drew himself up slightly.
It is none of my business, sir. I do not hold with gossip, and I do not encourage it below stairs.
Thank you, Villiers. That will be all.
Very good, sir. Thank you, sir.
Villiers bowed formally to Hawk, nodded politely to Fisher, and left.
I never met a butler yet who wouldn't be improved by a swift kick up the behind.
Right. Snobs. The lot of them. Even if he did know anything, he wouldn't tell the likes of us. It wouldn't be proper.
Maybe there's nothing to tell. Maybe there is no traitor, and this is all part of an elaborate smear job by the Conservatives to rattle adamant and undermine his confidence.
Oh, my head hurts.
Stick with it. The answer's here somewhere if we just dig deep enough. Those blood creatures were real enough. I'm damned if I'll let Adamant die the way Blackstone did.
All the day's talk and planning hadn't prepared Hawk and Fisher for the reality of life on the campaign trail. Adamant set out while the day was still young, taking with him Medley and Danielle, Hawk and Fisher, and a small army of followers, mercenaries, and speechwriters. Hawk felt a little insulted by the presence of the mercenaries. It seemed to imply that Adamant felt Hawk and Fisher weren't enough to ensure his safety. But once Adamant and his party ventured into the streets, the crowds quickly grew so thick and so vociferous that only the mercenaries kept him from being mobbed. Hawk and Fisher contented themselves with walking on either side of Adamant and glaring at anyone who got too close. The morning passed in a blur of streets and crowds and speeches. Adamant went from hall to hall, from meeting place to open gatherings, delivering endless speeches, raising the crowds to fever pitch and leaving them with a burning intent to vote reform, which would hopefully last until polling time later that evening. Adamant's followers spread coins around to anyone with enough wit to stick out an empty palm, and the free booze flowed like water. The speechwriters busied themselves with constant rewrites to suit specific areas, often thrusting hastily scrawled extra lines into Adamant's hands only moments before he was due to make his speech. Somehow he always managed to learn them in time to deliver the lines as though he'd only just thought of them. Hawk was impressed. And yet, for all the carefully crafted speeches and crowd handling, the one thing that stood out whenever Adamant spoke was his sincerity, and the crowds recognized it. He believed in his cause, and he made the crowds believe. Down on Eel Street, they found a landlord dictating how his tenants should vote on pain of eviction. Adamant did a half-hour speech on the evils of oppression and the virtues of the secret ballot. Fisher punched the landlord in the mouth. Not far away, in Baker Street, Hardcastle had planted a sorcerously altered double of Adamant to make damaging claims and speeches. Unfortunately for him, he grew too enamored of the sound of his own voice and didn't get out of the area fast enough. Adamant's mercenaries took care of the double's protectors, and Hawk and Fisher caught up with him before he managed to get even a dozen yards away.
No! Wait!
We need a little truth from you. Who hired you?
I can't tell you!
What was that name? We didn't catch it.
Don't you realize what he'll do to me?
Adamant made a blockbuster speech on the need to outlaw dirty tricks in politics.
Your turn, Hawk.
Thanks, Isabel.
No!
Hawk and Fisher were taking turns dunking the double in a horse trough until he admitted who hired him.
All right! All right! I'll tell you!
A bunch of rather shabbily dressed people began following Adamant and his entourage from location to location. They shouted impertinent questions and generally made a nuisance of themselves, but Adamant let them get away with it. Hawk and Fisher began to grow a little annoyed with them. Medley spotted the danger signs.
They're reporters! Please don't break them!
We don't hit everyone we don't like.
Of course not. It just seems that way. Look, we need the press on our side. The two main papers may be written by and for the quality and the upper middle classes, but they have votes too. And they have a lot of influence over how other people vote. Luckily for us, Hardcastle's always hated the press and never made any bones about it. So anything that makes us look good is going to get reported. And that's another nail in Hardcastle's coffin. Besides, a lot of the reporters out there are freelancers, making notes for broadsheets. We definitely don't want to upset them.
So now, let us rejoice in this symbol of our care for those among us too poor, too young to care for themselves. We can do better. We must do better.
Hadaman finished his speech about the opening of a small free hospital for the poor and needy. He then formally declared the hospital open, cut a length of ribbon that served no purpose Hawk could make out, and got cheered again.
We'll never understand politics.
Hawk leaned against a nearby wall and surveyed the scene before him. Everything seemed quiet, the crowd was friendly, and there was no sign of any more of Hardcastle's men. Hawk nodded, satisfied, and seized the chance for a short rest. The campaign trail so far had been hard and tiring, and there was still a lot of territory to cover. He looked around to see how the others were taking the strain. Fisher looked calm and collected, but then it took a lot to get to Fisher. Adamant was in his element and had never looked better. Danielle, on the other hand, had found an overturned crate to sit on. Her face was pale and drawn, her shoulders were slumped with tiredness, and her hands were shaking. Hawk frowned. Villiers had said she was ill. Hawk decided to keep an eye on her. If she didn't find her second wind soon, he'd have Fisher escort her home. The last thing Adamant needed was something else to worry about. Danielle would be safe enough with Fisher and maybe a couple of mercenaries just to be on the safe side. Hawk looked around for Medley to tell him what he intended and felt a sudden chill as he realized there was no sign of him. He turned quickly to Fisher, who smiled briefly.
Don't panic. He just ducked into the inn across the road for a quick drink. He'll be back before we have to move on. You're getting old, Hawk. Missing things like that?
Right. This election is putting years on me.
The inn wasn't much to look at, even by high steps standards. Inside, the lights were dim enough to keep everything vague and indistinct. Most of the patrons preferred it that way, but then they weren't much to look at either. It was that kind of neighborhood. Medley didn't mind. This was where he'd first met his lady love, and it would always be a special place to him. He nodded to the indifferent bartender behind the stained wooden bar and moved quickly on to the private booths at the back of the inn. She was there, waiting for him, just as she'd promised. As always, just the sight of her was enough to make his heart beat faster. He sat down beside her, and his hands reached out and found hers. They sat staring into each other's eyes for a long moment, and it seemed to Medley that he'd never been so happy.
I can't stay long. Now, what's so important that I had to come here today? You know I'm always glad to see you, but with Adamant's people just outside...
She smiled and squeezed his hands.
I know. I'm sorry, but I had to see you. I didn't know when I'd be able to get away again. How's your campaign going?
Fine, fine. Look, I can't stay long, or they'll come looking for me, and we can't afford to be seen even talking together.
I know. They wouldn't understand. They'd stop us from seeing each other.
I wouldn't let them. There's nothing in the world I value more than you.
You say the nicest things. I love you, Stefan.
I love you too, Roxanne.
Cameron Hardcastle strode steadily and purposefully through the high steps, and the people lined the streets to watch him pass. Armed mercenaries surrounded him at all times, making sure the crowds kept a respectful distance. The bunting he'd ordered put up hung limply on the still air, and although his people handed out conservative flags and banners by the dozen well in advance, he could only see a few waving. If not for the sparse applause as they marched, the streets would have been embarrassingly quiet. Hardcastle smiled tightly. That would change soon enough. It always did once he started to speak. Jillian hurried quietly along beside him, eyes downcast as always. Hardcastle would just as happily have left her behind, but that was politically unacceptable. A strong marriage and a stable family were central tenets of conservative thinking, so he had to show off his own wife in public. It was expected of him. She wouldn't disgrace him. She wouldn't dare. The sorcerer Wolf walked a few paces behind them, disguised as one of the mercenaries. He couldn't afford to be recognized in public as Hardcastle's sorcerer. Firstly, it would upset the crowds. They tended to distrust magic, and everyone associated with it, usually with good reason. Secondly, his support was illegal. And thirdly, he would have made too tempting a target. A great many people would have liked a chance at him, but he couldn't let Hardcastle walk the streets unprotected for the same reason. Even more people would have liked to see Counselor Hardcastle dead. So the great sorcerer Wolf tramped the streets of Haven in Hardcastle's shadow, sweating profusely under a mercenary's chainmail. Besides, he had to be there. Hardcastle couldn't make his speeches without him. Hardcastle himself was in a surprisingly good mood. His speeches had all gone down very well, and according to first reports, his mercenaries were winning practically every encounter with adamants. He reached the platform his people had prepared for him and climbed the steps onto the stage. Jillian came and stood quietly at his side, smiling blankly at the crowd. Despite their cheering, each member of the crowd had one eye warily watching the mercenaries. Hardcastle smiled, and the crowd's attention became fixed and rapt. A wave of euphoria and commitment swept over them, and soon they were stamping and shouting. He lifted his hands for quiet, and silence fell quickly across the packed street.
My friends, today I come before you, your humble servant.
By the end of the speech, the crowd was his to a man. He could have ordered them naked and unarmed into battle, and they would have gone. Hardcastle smiled out over the cheering crowd, relishing the power he had over them. There was a slight disturbance to one side as someone pushed their way through the crowd towards him. Hardcastle tensed and then relaxed a little as he recognized Roxanne. He gestured quickly for her to join him on the platform.
I was beginning to wonder where you were.
He smiled at the crowd.
Just taking care of business.
I suppose I might as well make use of you while you're here.
Hardcastle nodded graciously to her as though he'd been expecting her, and then held up his hands for quiet again.
My friends, may I present to you the latest addition to our ranks, the renowned warrior Roxanne. I'm sure you all know her fine reputation.
He paused for a cheer that didn't come. The crowd stirred uneasily.
Oh, great. Someone send for the fire brigade now while there's still time.
One of the mercenaries moved in quickly to shut him up with a mailed fist to the kidneys, but the damage had been done. The mood of the crowd had been broken. Most of the people there had heard of Roxanne, and while they were undoubtedly impressed, they were also extremely worried, if not downright scared. Her reputation had preceded her. She looked out over the crowd with a raised eyebrow, but had enough sense not to smile. Wolf glared surreptitiously about him, testing the feel of the crowd, and didn't like what he found. The euphoria of a moment before had vanished, as though it had never been. Wolf shrugged. There would be other times. He moved in close beside the platform and looked up at Hardcastle.
I think we should be leaving now, Cameron, and in the future we might be wise to keep Roxanne in the background.
Hardcastle nodded curtly. He turned to give the order to leave. He stared blankly about him, angry and confused, and then he saw the rats moving among the crowd. Hundreds of rats, in all shapes and sizes, many still sleek and shining with slime from the sewers. They scurried this way and that, mad with rage, sinking fangs and claws into anything that came within range. Hardcastle's hands clenched into fists and his face reddened. There was only one way so many rats could have appeared in one place at one time, and that was by magic. A sorcerer must have teleported them into the crowd. Adamant's sorcerer. Wolf fought his way back to the platform.
We have to get out of here, Cameron. There's too many of them. There's nothing I can do.
Hardcastle nodded stiffly and signaled for his mercenaries to open a path through the chaos. A blazing anger pulled at his self-control as he descended from the platform, followed by Jillian and Roxanne. One way or another, Adamant would pay for this insult, whatever it cost. Hardcastle arrived at his next meeting place to find a crowd already gathered, listening to someone else address them. He brought his people to a halt and gestured to one of his mercenary officers.
I thought you said you'd clear the reformers out of this area.
I did, sir. I can't understand it. My people were most thorough. I left men here with strict instructions not to allow any other speakers. If you'll excuse me, sir, I'll go and see what's happening.
He gestured quickly to a half dozen of his men. They drew their swords and followed him into the crowd. Wolf stirred suddenly at Hardcastle's side.
There's trouble here, Cameron. Bad trouble.
My people will take care of it.
I don't think so. Not this time. There's a power here, and I don't like it. It's old magic. Wild magic.
Hardcastle frowned impatiently and turned to glare at him.
What the hell are you talking about, Wolf?
The sorcerer was staring at the man addressing the crowd, and Hardcastle reluctantly followed his gaze. The man was tall and slender, wrapped in a shabby gray cloak that had seen better days. He was too far away for Hardcastle to hear what he was saying, but there was no denying the impact his words had on the crowd. They couldn't take their eyes off him. And yet there was none of the shouting and clapping that Hardcastle's own speeches always elicited. The crowd was almost eerily silent, utterly engrossed with the speaker. Hardcastle suddenly realized the mercenaries he'd sent into the crowd hadn't come back. He looked quickly about him, but there was no sign of them anywhere. Roxanne drew her sword from its scabbard.
They've been gone too long. Want me to go look for them?
Not on your own. Jillian, you stay here with my people. Wolf, you and Roxanne follow me. We're going to take a closer look at this phenomenon.
Two of Hardcastle's mercenaries opened up a path through the crowd for him. More mercenaries spread out through the crowd, flanking Hardcastle and his party as they moved. No one in the crowd paid them any attention, their gaze fixed on the slight gray figure on the platform that Hardcastle considered his. There was no sign of any of the missing mercenaries.
I am the Lord of the Gulfs!
Greyvale stood on the platform, his eyes wide and unblinking, his face full of a cold and awful wonder.
He has given me power! Power beyond imagining! And he will do the same for you! Only come to him and serve him! And he will make you masters among men. He is ancient and magnificent, older than mankind itself. And his time has come again.
Hardcastle frowned and looked about him. The gray figure was saying nothing new, and on the Street of Gods, no one would have given him a second glance. So why was everyone so rapt? Why weren't there any hecklers in the crowd? He muttered instructions to the nearest mercenary, who nodded and moved quickly through the crowd, passing the instructions on to the other mercenaries.
You're crazy!
The gray veil turned slowly to face the jeers. The veil stopped speaking and raised his hands above his head. The day suddenly grew dark. Hardcastle looked up and saw the sky was full of angry, swollen clouds, cutting off the daylight and spreading a chill across the crowd. He frowned uncertainly. He would have sworn the sky had been clear only moments before. He looked back at the gray figure, just in time to flinch as lightning cracked down to strike the upraised hands. An eerie blue glow crackled around the gray veil's hands, and then the lightning leapt out into the crowd, striking down each and every one of Hardcastle's men who raised their voices in mockery. The crowd shrank back as the mercenaries burst into flames and fell dying to the ground. The smell of burnt flesh filled the air, but somehow the crowd still held their ground instead of scattering, bound together by the Grey Veil's will. He slowly lowered his hands, and the sky began to clear. The Veil smiled at Hardcastle and fixed him with his disturbingly direct gaze.
What else would you have me do? Shall I call down the rain or call up a hurricane? Shall I fill your lungs with water or cause your blood to boil in your veins? Or shall I heal the sick and raise the dead? I can do all those things and more. The Lord of the Gulfs has given me power beyond your petty dreams.
Want me to kill him?
You wouldn't get within 10 feet of him. Cameron, let me deal with him.
Do it. Destroy him. No one murders my men and gets away with it.
I wouldn't stand any more of a chance than Roxanne. I told you, he has the wild magic in him.
So what do we do?
If we're lucky, we make a deal.
Wolf made his way through the silent crowd and approached the platform. He and the Grey Veil spoke together for some time, and then Wolf bowed to him and made his way back to Hardcastle and Roxanne. His face was carefully impassive, but there was no hiding its pallor or the beads of sweat on his forehead.
Well,
he's agreed to meet with us privately. I think we can do business.
Who the hell is he? And what's this Lord of the Gulfs nonsense? I've never heard of him.
You wouldn't. It's a very old name. You probably know him better as the Abomination.
The Abomination was destroyed. Every schoolchild knows that. Its temple on the Street of Guards has been abandoned for centuries.
Apparently he's back. Not as powerful as he was, or he wouldn't need to make deals with us.
Hardcastle nodded, back on familiar ground.
All right. What does he want?
That's what we're going to discuss.
Wolf looked sharply at Hardcastle.
Cameron, we've got to get him on our side. Whatever it takes, with his power, he could hand us the election on a plate.
What if the price is too high?
No price is too high.
Dressed in checkered black and white, with a white clown's face and a domino mask, Harlequin dances on the Street of Gods. No one has ever seen his eyes, and he casts no shadow. He dances with a splendid ease, graceful and magnificent, pirouetting elegantly to a music only he can hear, and he never stops. Morning, noon, and night, Harlequin dances on the Street of Gods. Everyone needs something to believe in. Something to make them feel safe and secure and cared for. They need it so badly they'll give up anything and everything just for the promise of it. They'll pay in gold and obedience and suffering and anything else that has a market value. Which is why religion is such big business in Haven. Right in the center of the city, square in the middle of the high rent district, lies the Street of Gods. Dozens of different churches and temples stand side by side and ostentatiously ignore each other. Then there are the smaller, more intimate meeting houses for adherents of the lesser known or more controversial beliefs, who for the most part deal strictly in cash. And then there are the street preachers. No one knows where they came from or where they go, but every day they turn up by the hundreds to line the Street of Gods and spread the word to anyone who'll listen. There's never any trouble in the Street of Gods. Firstly, the beings wouldn't like it, and secondly, it's bad for business. The people of Haven firmly believe in the right of everyone to make a profit. Or profit. Hawk and Fisher looked curiously about them as they accompanied Adamant down the Street of Gods. It wasn't a part of Haven they knew much about, but they knew enough to be wary. Anything could happen on the Street of Gods. Not for the first time, Hawk wondered if they'd done the right thing in leaving the mercenaries behind. But Adamant insisted. He left his followers behind as well. Apart from his bodyguards, only Medley and Danielle remained with him now.
We're here to ask a favor. That means we come as supplicants, not as heads of a private army.
Besides, we're here to make deals. We don't need witnesses.
The street itself was a mess. The assorted temples and churches varied widely in size and shape and style of architecture. Fashions from one century stood side by side with modes and follies from another. The street itself stretched away into the distance for as far as Hawk could see, and his hackles stirred.
The Street of Gods is a hell of a lot larger than the official maps make it out to be, Medley.
The street is as long as it has to be to fit everything in. With so many magics and sorcerers and beings of power jammed together, it's no wonder things get a little strange here from time to time.
You got that right.
Fisher watched with interest as a street preacher thrust metal skewers through his flesh. He showed no sign of pain, and no blood ran from the wounds. Another preacher poured oil all over his body and set himself on fire. He waited until he'd burned out, and then did it again.
Ignore them. They're just exhibitionists. It takes more than spectacle to impress anyone here.
Adamant looked expectantly at Medley.
What's the latest news, Stefan?
Medley gathered together a handful of notes and papers presented to him by messengers reporting on the day's progress.
So far, not bad. Hardcastle's mercenaries are wiping the streets with ours whenever the two sides meet. But they can't be everywhere at once. All the main posts are us running neck and neck with Hardcastle, which is actually pretty good for this early in the campaign. We could even improve as the day goes on. Wait until the drink wears off, and they've spent all their bribe money. Then we'll see how many conservative voters stay bought. Mortis has been keeping busy. Apparently he's broken up several conservative meetings by teleporting rats into the crowd. His sense of humor has got very basic since he died. As for the other candidates, General Longarm has been making some very powerful speeches. He seems to be building quite a following among the city men-at-arms. Megan O'Brien isn't getting anywhere. Even his fellow traitors don't believe he can win. And Lord Arthur Sinclair was last seen hosting a one hell of a party at the Crippled Cougar Inn and getting smashed out of his skull. No surprises there.
They walked on a while in silence. In the Street of Gods, the time of day fluctuated from place to place, so that they walked sometimes in daylight and sometimes in moonlight. Once it snowed briefly and rained frogs, and the stars in the sky outshone the sun. Gargoyles wept blood and statues stirred on their pedestals. Once Hawk looked down a side alley and saw a skeleton held together by copper wire beating its skull against a stone wall over and over again. And for a time, a flock of burning birds followed Adamant's party down the street. Adamant always looked straight ahead, ignoring everything outside of his path. And after a while, Hawk and Fisher learned to do the same.
How many gods are there here?
No one knows. The number's changing all the time. There's something here for everyone.
Who do you believe in?
I was raised Orthodox. Brotherhood of Steel. I suppose I'm still a believer. It appeals to my pragmatic nature. And unlike most religions, they're not always bothering me for donations.
Right. You pay your tithes once a year, show up at meetings once a month, and they pretty much leave you alone. But it's a good church to belong to. You can make very useful contacts through the Brotherhood.
Tell me about the Brotherhood. Isabel and I haven't had much contact with them here, and they're not very well known in the Northlands where we were raised.
They're pretty straightforward. Part militaristic, part mystical, based upon a belief in the fighting man. It started out as a warrior's religion, but it's broadened its appeal since then. They revere cold steel in all its forms as a weapon, and teach that all men can be equal once they've trained to be fighting men. It's a particularly practical-minded religion.
And if we can get their support, every man-at-arms in the high steps will vote for us.
I would have thought they'd be more interested in Hardcastle.
Normally, yes. But, luckily for us, Hardcastle has not only not paid his tithes in years, he also had the effrontery to levy a special tax on the Brotherhood in his territory. And on top of that, just recently the Brotherhood's been split down the middle by an argument over how involved they should get in local politics. The new militant sect already has one seat on the council, the Downs. Their candidate in the steps is General Longarm. We're going to see the High Commander of the Orthodox sect and see if we can stir up some support for us as part of their struggle against the militants.
Great. Just what this campaign needs. More complications.
Adamant looked at Hawk.
How about you, Captain? What do you believe in?
Hard cash, cold beer, and an axe with a good edge. I was raised as a Christian, but that was a long time ago.
A Christian?
Danielle raised a painted eyebrow.
Takes all sorts to make a world, I suppose.
Who exactly are we here to see?
There are only a few beings who will talk to us. Most of them won't interfere in Haven's civil affairs.
Why not?
Because if one got involved, they all would. And it wouldn't be long before we had a god war on our hands. No one wants that, least of all the beings. They've got a good racket here, and no one wants to rock the boat. There are a few beings who have developed a taste for a little discreet and indirect meddling. The trick is to get to them before Hardcastle does. I think we'll start with the Speaking Stone.
The Speaking Stone turned out to be a huge jagged boulder of granite, battered and weather-beaten beyond all shape or meaning. Plainly robed acolytes guarded it with drawn swords all the time Adamant and his party were there. After all the things he'd seen so far on the Street of Gods, Hawk was very disappointed in the stone. He tried hard to feel some holy atmosphere or mystical aura, but the stone looked like just another lump of rock to him. Adamant spoke with the stone for some time, but if it had anything to say for itself, Hawk didn't hear it. Adamant seemed neither pleased nor displeased, but if he had got anything out of his visit, he kept it to himself. The Madonna of the Martyrs had a bad reputation. Her church was tucked away in a quiet little backwater of the Street of Gods. There were no signs to proclaim what it was. The people who needed to would always find their way there. There was a constant stream of supplicants to the Madonna's doors, the lost and the lonely, the beaten and the betrayed. They came to the Madonna with heavy hearts, and she gave them what they asked for, an end to all pain. After they died, they rose again in her service for as long as she required them. Some called her a god, some a devil. There isn't always that much difference in the Street of Gods. The Madonna herself turned out to be a plain, pleasant woman, dressed in gaudily colored robes. She had a tray of sickly-looking boiled sweets at her side and sucked one noisily all the time they were there. She didn't offer them around, and Hawk, for one, was grateful. Dead men and women shuffled through her chamber on unknown errands. Their faces were colorless and slack, but once or twice Hawk thought he caught a quick glimpse of something damned and suffering in their eyes. He kept his hand near his axe and his eye on the nearest exit. Adamant and the Madonna made a deal. In return for her withdrawing her support for the DeWitt brothers, Adamant would allow the Madonna access to the High Steps hospitals. It wasn't quite as cold as it sounded. The Madonna was bound by her nature only to take the willing, and every hospital has some who would welcome death as a release from pain. Even so, Hawk studied Adamant thoughtfully. He'd always suspected the politician had a ruthless streak. He caught Medley's eye on the way out, but the advisor just shrugged. La Belle Dame du Rocher, the beautiful lady of the rocks, refused to see them. So did the Soror Marium, the sister of the sea. They were both old patrons of Haven, and Adamant was clearly disappointed. He left an offering for each of them anyway, just in case. The hanged man was polite but noncommittal. The Carrion in Tears asked too high a price, and the Crawling Violet's answer made no sense at all. And so it went down the Street of Gods. Even those few beings who would allow Adamant to approach them were usually uninterested in his problems. They had their own affairs and vendettas to pursue. Adamant remained calm and polite throughout it all, and Hawk kept his hand near his axe. The various beings were disturbing enough, but their followers gave him the creeps. They all had the same flat, unwavering stare of the fanatic. Finally, when they had been everywhere else, Adamant brought his party to the Brotherhood of Steel. Their headquarters looked less like a church and more like an upmarket barracks. The carved wood and stonework was only a few hundred years out of date, which made the place look almost modern compared to most of the Street of Gods. Armed guards patrolled the front of the building, but fell back respectfully once they recognized Adamant. Hawk looked at him sharply.
You're not just a casual visitor here, are you?
I've had dealings with the Brotherhood before. Every politician has.
A scarred man-at-arms in brightly shining chainmail led them through a series of open corridors to an impressively large library, where he left them. Fisher grabbed the most comfortable chair and sank into it, stretching out her long legs. Hawk was tempted to do the same. His feet were killing him. But every instinct he had was telling him to keep alert. Every man he saw in the headquarters wore a sword, and looked like he knew how to use it. If by some chance Hardcastle had already been here and struck a deal with the Brotherhood, getting out of the headquarters might prove a lot more difficult than getting in. He sat on the arm of Fisher's chair and fixed Adamant with a steady gaze.
All right, Sir Adamant, who are we waiting to see?
Jeremiah Rucker. He's the commander here. Not a bad sort. We can talk with him.
How does he feel about reform?
Couldn't care less, one way or the other. Officially, the Brotherhood is above politics. Actually, they'll work with anyone if it's kept under the table and the price is right. And the Brotherhood strikes a very hard bargain.
Just how much influence does the Brotherhood really have in Haven?
More than you'd think. Essentially, any man who can wield a sword or an axe can apply for membership in the Brotherhood. Once admitted, they can learn skills and tactics preserved over hundreds of years and become part of a mystical fellowship that owes loyalty to nothing save itself. A brother of steel will defy any law, ruler, or religion if the Brotherhood requires it.
And there are brothers everywhere, in the Council, in the Guard, and in all the political parties.
How can you be sure of that?
This is Haven, remember? Nothing stays secret here for long.
Adamant looked at Hawk steadily.
According to my sources, the Brotherhood has spread throughout the Low Kingdoms, even among the King's advisors. So far, they've managed to avoid a purge by declaring themselves totally impartial when it comes to politics. But the new militants may change all that.
So why have we come here? Why should the Orthodox Brotherhood want to make a deal with reform?
Hawk paused, and his face cleared suddenly.
Of course. The most important thing for them is to see that the militants lose this election. In the steps, that means backing either Hardcastle or you, and they know they can't trust Hardcastle. I think I'm getting the hang of politics.
There's more to politics than just being cynical.
Hawk spun around, one hand dropping to his axe. A tall, impressively muscled man in his mid-40s stood smiling in the library doorway. He paused a moment to make sure they'd all got a good look at him, and then he strode forward into the room. His polished chainmail gleamed brightly in the lamplight, and a long sword hilt peered over his left shoulder. The sword on his back reached almost to the floor. His jet-black hair framed sharp classical features that were a little too perfect to be handsome, and a broad smile that wasn't reflected in his eyes. All in all, he looked more like a politician than Adamant did. Hawk nodded warily to the newcomer, who smiled briefly in his direction before bowing formally to Adamant.
Jeremiah Rucker, at your service once again, Sir Adamant. It's always good to see you here. Won't you introduce me to your companions?
Of course, Commander. This is my wife, Danielle. You know Medley, my advisor. The two guards are Captains Hawk and Fisher. Perhaps you've heard of them.
Yes, I've heard of them.
Do we have a problem, Commander?
We don't. Your reputation as a warrior precedes you, but your woman also claims the rights of a warrior, and that is unacceptable.
Fisher rose lithely to her feet and stood next to Hawk, one hand resting idly on her sword hilt. Rucker drew himself up to his full height and fixed her with a cold stare.
Women do not use weapons. They are not suited to it. They know nothing of the glory of steel.
Nice-looking sword you've got there. Want to go a few rounds?
Isabel.
Don't worry, I won't damage him too much. Just take some of the wind out of his sails. Come on, Rucker, what do you say? Best 3 out of 5? I'll give you 2 points to start with, just to make the match even.
Adamant glared at her and then at Hawk.
Captain, if you wouldn't mind...
Don't look at me. She goes her own way. Always has. Besides, if Rucker's stupid enough to take her on, he deserves everything that happens to him. If I were you, I'd send for a doctor. And a mop.
Rucker stared haughtily at Fisher. The effect was rather spoiled because he had to look up slightly to do it.
A brother of steel does not fight with women. It is not seemly.
Yeah, sure.
Isabel turned away and sat down in the chair again. Rucker ignored her and inclined his head courteously to Hawk.
I understand you worked with the legendary Adam Stalker on your last case, Captain Hawk. He was a great man. His death is a loss to us all.
There's no doubt he'll be missed. Was he a brother of steel?
Of course, all the great heroes are. You might care to make application yourself someday. Your skills and reputation would make you a valued member.
Thanks, but I'm not really the joining type.
Don't dismiss us so casually, Captain. We have much to offer.
Rucker fixed Hawk with a burning gaze.
The Brotherhood is dedicated to the glory of steel. It is the symbol that holds mankind together, that enables him to impose order on a savage and uncaring universe. Steel gives us mastery over the world and ourselves. In learning to control our bodies and our weapons, we learn to control our minds and our destinies. Think of what we could teach you, Captain. Every move, every trick and skill of fighting there has ever been is to be found here somewhere, in our libraries and instructors. Our fighters are unbeatable, our warriors suitable to advise kings. We are the future. We decide the way the world will turn.
Thanks, but I have enough problems dealing with the present. Besides, Isabel and I are a team. We work together, always.
And that's why you'll never be anything more than a city guard. A pity. You could have gone far, Hawk, if it hadn't been for your woman.
Commander, I'm giving you a lot of slack because I'm here as Adamant's guest. But if you insult my wife one more time, I will hurt you severely. Even worse, I might let Isabel do it. Now, be a good fellow and get on with your business with Adamant.
Rucker flushed pinkly, and his hand rose to the sword hilt at his shoulder. Hawk and Fisher were both on their feet facing him, weapons drawn and at the ready before Rucker's hand could close around the hilt. Adamant moved quickly forward to stand between them.
That's enough! Hawk, Fisher, put your weapons away. That's an order. I do apologize, Commander. We've had a very trying day, and I fear all our nerves are somewhat on edge.
Rucker nodded stiffly and took his hand away from his sword. Bright spots of color burned on his cheekbones, but when he spoke, his voice was perfectly steady.
Of course, James. I quite understand. Let's get down to business, shall we? What exactly can I do for you?
Hardcastle's mercenaries are grinding my campaign into the ground. My people are holding their own for the moment, but they can't last long without armed support. I need your support, Jeremiah. I need your men.
Rucker pursed his lips thoughtfully.
The Brotherhood doesn't take sides, James. You know that. We're above politics. We have to be.
The militants feel differently.
They're fools. We are only allowed free rein as long as we support all sides equally. We're not strong enough yet to stand as a political force in our own right. We survive because we're useful. But the powers that be would crush us in a moment if they thought we were dangerous. No, James, we've worked together in the past, when we found ourselves walking the same path. But we can't afford to be openly allied with your cause.
You can't afford not to. According to all the reports, General Longarm and his militants are doing very well at the moment. They haven't got enough support to win on their own, but if they were to ally themselves with Hardcastle, they'd make an unbeatable team. And Hardcastle's just rattled enough by their successes and mine to agree to such an alliance.
You make a good argument, James, but not good enough. Longarm's certainly ambitious, but he's not stupid enough to trust promises from Hardcastle.
Who said anything about trust? For the moment, they need each other, but all kinds of things could happen once the election is safely over. After all, Hardcastle maintains his position through armed force, forces that in the future would be exclusively controlled by General Longarm. But you're missing the point, Jeremiah. The point is, can you afford to bet that Longarm won't make an alliance with Hardcastle?
No, I can't. All right, James. I'll have to consult with the High Commander, but I'm pretty sure he'll say yes. We can't allow Longarm to win this election. You'll have your men in a few hours, and we should be able to call off most of Hardcastle's mercenaries. A large proportion of them belong to the Brotherhood. You've got your support, James, but you better make damn sure I don't have reason to regret it.
Out on the Street of Gods, three different clocks were striking 15, although it was still barely midday. Given some of the street's earlier excesses, Hawk felt only a wild relief that nothing worse was happening. He looked carefully about him and then stopped as a commotion broke out farther down the street. Fisher noticed his reaction and her hand dropped to her sword.
Trouble, Hawk?
Could be. Take a look.
Halfway down on the other side of the street, a very tall woman dressed in bright yellow and battered leathers was beating up half a dozen nuns from the convent of the Bright Lady. The nuns were armed with wooden staves and lengths of steel chain, but the tall woman was wiping the floor with them, using only her bare hands.
Who the hell is that?
That is Roxanne. I'm surprised you haven't heard of her.
Roxanne lifted a nun bodily into the air and slammed her face first into the nearest wall.
So that's Roxanne. I always thought she'd be taller.
There's a good price on her head.
With her reputation as a fighter, there'd have to be. I'm not tackling her without being paid extra.
Yeah, she's probably overrated. No one's that good.
Bets?
Roxanne headbutted one nun and punched out another.
All right, who goes first?
Toss you for it.
Fisher fumbled for a coin.
Wait a minute. Look!
Hawk and Fisher looked back just in time to see two new figures dragging Roxanne away from her latest victims, just as she was about to start putting the boot in. She shrugged them off easily, but made no move to attack them. Hawk recognized one of them as Counselor Hardcastle. The other man, dressed in ill-fitting chainmail, was the sorcerer Wolf. Hawk studied him thoroughly. He'd heard about Wolf.
Now that is interesting. I didn't know Roxanne was working for Hardcastle.
She won't be much longer. She's about to be arrested.
I'd rather you didn't. We don't want to draw attention to ourselves. Officially, we were never here. Our agreement with the Brotherhood will last only as long as we can keep it quiet. In fact, we better get out of here now, before Hardcastle spots us. Right, James?
I'm afraid so. If it's a question of the bounty money, Captain Hawk.
It isn't. She's wanted on a dozen warrants, most of them for murder and arson, but she can wait. Protecting you is top priority until I receive fresh orders. Let's go.
Fisher nodded reluctantly, and the party moved quickly off down the Street of Gods, keeping to the shadows.
It's probably just as well. Roxanne's supposed to be unbeatable with a sword.
I could take her.
I'm sure you could. After the election.
Well, at least now we've got something to look forward to.
Roxanne liked the Street of Gods. Its constantly shifting realities appealed to her own mercurial nature. She almost felt at home. Of course, not everyone felt the same. The street had terrorized Jillian to the point that not even Hardcastle's threats could make her accompany them. He sent her home, along with all his followers and mercenaries. The Grey Veil had insisted on that. Apparently, his god didn't like large audiences when it came to hard bargaining. Roxanne kept a close watch on Vale. She didn't trust him any further than she could spit into the wind. Vale led them past churches and temples decorated with imps and gargoyles and demons. None of them looked to be particularly healthy places. Vale passed them all by, and Roxanne pouted with disappointment. Finally, they came to the Temple of the Abomination, and Vale smiled sardonically as he took in their reactions. It wasn't much to look at, just a plain stone building with no windows, the stonework scarred and pitted by long years of neglect, but something about it put Roxanne's teeth on edge. Vale gestured for his guests to enter. Hardcastle and Wolf looked at the rough wooden door hanging slightly ajar, and then looked at Roxanne. She grinned broadly, drew her sword, and moved forward to kick the door open. At the last moment, the door swung open before her. Roxanne stopped and waited a moment, but there was no one there. The gloom beyond the door was still and quiet. She looked back at Vale. He was watching her mockingly with his disquieting eyes. Roxanne turned her back on him and swaggered into the Temple of the Abomination. A dim crimson glow filled the huge stone hall, radiating in some obscure fashion from a broken stone altar. The hall stretched away into the distance, and the ceiling towered impossibly high above her. Roxanne moved slowly forward, her sword held out before her. There was a sluggish movement of shadows, but nothing came out of the gloom to challenge her. Roxanne curled her lip disappointedly. She spun around, but it was only Vale leading Hardcastle and Wolf into the temple. Roxanne went back to join them. Hardcastle looked briefly about him and did his best to look unimpressed.
All right, we're here. Now tell me why I've come all this way to a deserted temple when I could be talking with beings of real power.
Gently, Cameron. You don't know what you're dealing with here.
And you do?
I think so, yes. You're one of the transient beings, aren't you?
What the hell's a transient being?
An abstraction given shape and form. A concept clothed in flesh and blood and bone. They have power beyond reason, for their birth lies in wild magic, and once summoned into the world of men, they cannot easily be dismissed.
Roxanne frowned at the slender figure wrapped in gray before her.
You mean he's a god?
The Lord of the Ghosts has been asleep for centuries, and it will be some time before he can physically manifest himself in this world again. For now, he needs a host to walk in the world of men.
Hardcastle scowled unhappily.
What kind of being are you?
The light around them grew subtly darker, like sunset fading into night. Here and there in the gloom, pale sparks of light appeared, growing quickly into transparent human shapes. Soon there were hundreds of ghosts glowing palely in the great hall, drifting endlessly back and forth as though in search of something they could no longer remember. All of them were hideously shriveled and emaciated, reduced by some awful hunger to nothing more than flesh-covered skeletons with distended bellies and wide, agonized eyes. More and more appeared until they filled the hall from end to end, and then without warning they turned upon each other, tearing ravenously at their ghostly flesh with frenzied hands and teeth. They ate each other with desperate haste, screaming silently at the horror of what they did, but the broken bones and ripped flesh brought no end to their hunger.
I have had many names, but only one nature. Call me Hunger. Call me Famine!
The ghosts were suddenly gone, and the gloom in the Temple of the Abomination was still and quiet once again.
The Lord of the Ghosts has more power than you could ever dream of. They drive me out again and again, but I always come back. Serve me. And my power is yours.
Serve you? How?
Bring me followers. The more who worship me, the greater my power will become. They will feed me with their devotion, and my influence will spread across the land as it did before. My host must be protected. I cannot be destroyed by the living or the dead. That gift was given to me at my creation. But my host is always vulnerable.
Can you destroy my enemies?
Of course.
Then you've got a deal, whatever you are.
Excellent. But this host has done all that it can. You got power enough to raise me, but not enough to sustain me. As a sign of good faith, you must provide me with a new host.
Take me. Let me share your power. I have enough sorcery to contain you until we can find your new host.
Vale looked at him and then smiled suddenly.
Very well, sorcerer. If that's what you want.
Wolf, are you sure you know what you're doing?
Of course I'm sure. Don't rock the boat.
The Grey Veil grinned widely, the smile spreading and spreading until the mouth cracked and broke, splitting the cheeks and opening up the face to show the bones and muscle beneath. The face sloughed off like a mask, and the muscles turned to dust and fell away. The eyes sank back into the sockets and disappeared, leaving only a grinning skull. Dust fell out of the grey robe in streams, and then it crumpled and fell limply to the floor. The jaw fell away from the skull in one silent laugh. And then, they too were gone, and there was only dust and an empty grey robe. A wind rose up out of nowhere and blew the dust away. Wolf put an unsteady hand to his mouth and shook his head slightly. His eyes were glazed as though he was listening to a faint voice very far away. Hardcastle looked at Roxanne and then back at Wolf.
I'm all right, Cameron.
Wolf lowered his hand slowly and smiled at Hardcastle.
He really wasn't very bright for a god. He hasn't been awake long, and he wasn't nearly as strong as he thought he was. I've got him, held securely within my wards, and all his power is mine. Adamant doesn't know it yet, but the election is yours, Cameron. No other sorcerer can stand against me now. Let's go!
The wooden door swung open, and Hardcastle and Wolf went back out into the Street of Gods. Roxanne looked around the deserted hall one last time and then followed them out. She put away her sword.
I wonder if there'll be time to stop for dinner anytime soon.